content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Fasten Your Belts. As domestic travel starts picking back up at RDU International Airport, international traffic numbers are being closely watched. And the cover story begins with a second headline inside the Triangle Business Journal, Ready for Takeoff. As the pandemic eases, passengers are returning to RDU, but critical infrastructure needs are ahead. Written by Lauren Onasorge. It was a windy day on what Bill Sandifer, Chief Operating Officer for Raleigh-Durham International Airport, says are the most important 2 miles of pavement in central North Carolina. The gray concrete seemed to go on forever, with the occasional darker block from where crumbling 18-inch thick panels have been replaced. To the left, a UPS plane taxied. Ahead and to the left, the control tower loomed. To the right, a long stretch of grass was being mowed by a tractor. There, Sandifer says, pointing to the grass about 600 feet from where he stands, that's where it'll be. The new, long-discussed runway is an important step that could cost well north of $250 million, he says. By fall of 2023, dirt will be moving. In 2027, if all goes well, planes will be taking off. The current 150-foot-wide stretch where Sandifer stands will shrink, becoming a parallel taxiway, and the airport's overnight closures to swap out the aging pavement in order to extend the current runway's life can stop. It's something Sandifer and his team have been working toward for years, before the 2017 Vision Plan was approved, before the pandemic halted taxi work in 2020. And it's not just about the planes taking off, it's also about Terminal 2, the main hub of the airport, where planes from carriers such as Delta Airlines, American Airlines, United Airlines, and Frontier Airlines pick up and drop off passengers. The current runway doesn't allow Terminal 2 to get bigger, and it has to get bigger to meet what's coming, Sandifer says. Pre-pandemic, it was a race against the clock as airport officials worried capacity couldn't keep up with the demand. Then came COVID and everything paused. Except for the runway, Sandifer says. The runway, the big constant, is the answer to it all, from international ambitions to capacity constraints. But with the pandemic changing everything from international air targets to labor costs, RDU officials worry that it can't happen soon enough, and they worry that the project, already expected to cost more than $250 million, could see its price tag keep accelerating. Really, the only thing that looks the same between flying before the pandemic and flying today are the airplanes, because airlines are deeply changed and the market, the U.S. market overall, is substantially changed, says Henry Hartefelt, president and travel industry analyst at Atmosphere Research Group. Pre-pandemic ambitions. For years, RDU had been bullish with its international ambitions. In 2017, it launched what RDU CEO Mike Landeguth called Operation Silk Road, an effort to secure a nonstop flight to China. I really believe this is the start of the process, he said 5 years ago to the board of directors. The airport hired a consultant to help it organize the effort and even held public meetings to get stakeholders from area businesses and universities involved in the effort. At the same time, the airport was also talking to airline officials about other wish list international locations such as Frankfurt, Germany, and Amsterdam. Among airlines confirmed to have been in conversations with RDU pre-pandemic are Irish carrier Aer Lingus and Iceland Air. International ambitions were coming at a time of unprecedented growth. And the runway, which in 2019 was expected to be a $350 million, 11,500-foot-long project at completion, wouldn't solve capacity challenges. In January 2020, lines were wrapping around the Terminal 2 lobby. Flight delays were not uncommon as airplanes waited for their turn at shared gates, a chess game, airport officials said at the time of the strategizing involved in managing arrivals and takeoffs. During peak morning hours, 28 of the 36 gates at Terminal 2 were routinely occupied, with another 20 planes parked remotely, overcrowding the aprons, Sandifer said then. Not all gates can accommodate the same size aircraft, Sandifer said in early 2020. We're constantly moving the chess pieces around, and it's difficult to put a precise mathematical number on gate capacity because there's a whole bunch of variables. The airport had a plan for growth, its Vision 2040 plan, passed back in 2017, but officials feared the plan, which budgeted capital projects based on projected demand, just couldn't keep up, as they were predicting that by the end of 2020, the airport could reach passenger levels not expected until 2036. Fast forward just 2 months to March, and that chessboard was wiped clean. Plans spearheaded by Sandifer to expedite projects to keep up with that unprecedented growth track stalled completely, and the airport, instead of allocating for projects to happen faster, switched to what officials called a survival budget. As passengers avoided air travel amid the rise of the virus, and international traffic disappeared. Numbers would start to tick up, so much so that economy parking lots returned to operation last year. But the transatlantic flights the airport had been so proud to score to London and Paris kept being delayed. And talk about a nonstop flight to China fizzled. Landguth now says Asian ambitions are at least 10 years out. But Landguth's team is once again recruiting international flight service, a lengthy process that involves outreach and information gathering. His team looks at current companies in the region and what their international travel needs are in order to identify targets. It then puts together a traffic forecast and also looks at what the cargo impact might be. We're in that information gathering phase, Landguth says. While many carrier conversations had been quite advanced pre-pandemic, the pitch has to completely start over, as a lot of things have changed. But it's not all bad. One factor in the Triangle's favor has been corporate interest, and big project wins during pandemic years, such as Apple, Google, and VinFast, may actually elevate that conversation, he says. But Hardefelt says RDU has its work cut out for it, as airlines are pickier with their networking decisions. RDU has the misfortune of being near major hubs, Americans in Charlotte and Delta's in Atlanta. RDU faces the challenge of being a thriving market, but one that is very close to primary hubs that airlines are going to put much more focus on before they rebuild RDU, he says. Adding a flight in and out of a major hub is generally going to produce far greater returns for the airline rather than adding what's called a point-to-point route from RDU to London or Paris. Hardefelt believes the transcontinental flights will return, but it's just a question of when. Right now, American plans to bring London back in June, with Delta bringing Paris back in August, but much of it comes down to the business traveler. A deal with British pharma GlaxoSmithKline to fill a set amount of seats is what finally helped to secure Americans' London flight, and a business coalition complete with private-funded marketing dollars is what finally lured Delta's service to Paris. The business traveler likely needs to step up again to bring them back, he says. New challenges. But demand is just part of the cost equation, and the math has changed over the past 2 years. Jet fuel has spiked. Regulations have been challenging, but labor may be the biggest variable. In the early days of the pandemic, airlines offered retirements and furloughs to many employees, laying off others as demand tanked. As the numbers start to creep up, they tried to bring employees back, but many had moved on to other jobs. Others were frustrated at having to police COVID restrictions on planes. An ongoing pilot shortage actually worsened as many had reached federally mandated retirement age. Labor, as with many industries, had become harder and more expensive to attract and retain. And crew shortages caused delays and even flight cancellations at numerous airlines. Executives at major carriers told analysts labor was impacting their network decisions. They had to be pickier than ever when it came to allocating their crews, and soft demand for both international and business-focused flying had them prioritizing leisure markets often over RDU. In recent days, top executives at major airlines and RDU's network have all said demand is picking up both for business travel and international routes. At American, for example, long-haul international travel was about 60% recovered in March, CEO Robert Isom told analysts on an April's earnings call. But staffing shortages continue to strain resources. Getting ahead of many of these staffing issues is critical because there is a long lead time for some of the roles, Joanna Garrity, chief operating officer at JetBlue, said on a recent earnings call. Not being able to fill roles quickly is stemming airlines' ability to add to its network, and that includes flights out of RDU. At Southwest Airlines, staffing challenges are a big growth headwind, particularly with a shorter stage length as we add back higher frequency business routes, Chief Financial Officer Tammy Romo said. The airline industry cut 75 flights from its May schedule, amounting to 12,000 fewer seats than had initially been allocated for RDU, according to data tracker Cirium. United Airlines President Bret Hart said staffing is among the reasons United has limited its schedule, something Hart told analysts will continue as it adds capacity in the upcoming months. Meanwhile, at RDU, ultra-low-cost carriers are taking advantage of the building demand. Carriers such as Frontier and new-to-RDU Avalo Airlines are a la carte, meaning they charge for extras such as checked bags and thus control some of their expenses, making new routes out of RDU a less risky bet than the dollars it would require for, say, Delta to bring its Paris flight back. Frontier has announced a slew of new flights in recent weeks. An international budget carrier, Icelandair, launched a nonstop flight to Reykjavik May 12th. The flight, which is in line for incentives from RDU, is expected to be a major connector to Europe. At Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, for example, about 95% of the people flying the route connect to a further destination in Europe, airport spokesman Patrick Hogan said. Icelandair CEO Bogi Nils Bogason recently said bookings for the RDU flight were strong. Hardefelt says that could be good news for international in general at RDU, as it's likely American and Delta are watching what happens with the flight. If Icelandair is successful enough to attract enough business people on its flights, it may send a wake-up call to the folks who work in route planning at Delta and American, he says, noting Icelandair would probably not have added RDU to its schedule if the London and Paris flights had been operating. A riskier gamble. But labor shortages and uncertain demand aren't the only reason major carriers may be reluctant to gamble on international flying at RDU. Lingering COVID restrictions are also giving airlines pause, particularly when it comes to entry testing. Hardefelt says a requirement that travelers have a negative COVID test before flying back to the U.S. is putting a damper on international travel, particularly corporate trips. A lot of companies right now are concerned about sending employees abroad, he says, noting that the requirement to get a negative COVID test within 24 hours of a flight is just too risky to some companies. Employees could be stuck in Europe, and companies don't want that stress and hassle for their employees. Major airlines have repeatedly lobbied the feds to take a second look at the restriction, with Delta President Glenn Hauenstein saying last month that travelers have a hesitancy to go abroad and risk being caught not being able to get back because of catching COVID. Altogether, Hardefelt compares the industry to Humpty Dumpty. It's going to take another year or two to put itself back together again, he says. Finding balance at RDU. In the meantime, RDU faces a budgetary dilemma. Just support the weakened demand that exists in 2022 or reinvest in capital programs to try to meet the capacity that's been expected for years. And RDU traditionally is not one to shy from growth. It has already restarted some of the projects that have been suspended in the pandemic. Just last month, officials discussed expanding the Economy 3 parking lot, but the runway continues to be a priority. Last month, the Federal Aviation Administration approved plans for what's now expected to be a 10,639-foot runway at RDU, but even before that approval, the airport has been consistent that the runway is a non-negotiable. The pavement was crumbling. Without ongoing effort, the massive blocks of pavement being replaced at night, it would be at the end of its useful life, Sandifer says. Add in the fact that more airlines have been moving to bigger planes and the airfield needed to be a continued priority. But with China in the rearview mirror due to geopolitics, it no longer had to be 11,500 feet. Sandifer says that after talking to the airlines, he learned Alaska Airlines planes were having issues with the size of the strip, meaning the 10,000-foot runway needed to be bigger. Armed with that information, it approached the FAA, which agreed with the assessment. Both American and Delta say they did not have any issues with transatlantic flights that would have required a bigger runway. And in a pinch, there are planes that could accommodate a flight to China at that size, though Sandifer says if service to Asia is ever again a priority, there would be options to extend the runway, and it's being built with a future extension in mind. But regardless of future international service, the runway just can't be completed fast enough, Sandifer says. Demand is ticking up quickly. The airport saw a 90% traffic increase from March 2021 to March 2022. And that's without the return of business travelers or those precious nonstops to Europe. Pre-pandemic, half of RDU's traffic came from business flyers, and it has yet to fully recover. An airport spokeswoman says RDU's latest estimate was that leisure, which picked up amid pandemic-related cabin fever, amounted to 60% of the current traffic. That business traveler customer is not completely back, Sandifer says. When they do, I'm concerned we're going to just explode. Add in the returns of nonstops to London and Paris, which have always leaned heavily toward international business travelers, and that could be a huge traffic jump, one that could bring back the Terminal 2 lines. Apron overcrowding and capacity challenges RDU battled 2 years ago. Add in the labor shortage, and it could be even more challenging for RDU to address. The key to solving the Terminal 2 capacity challenge is the possibility of actually expanding the building, something that can't happen until the new runway is built. When the runway moves nearly 600 feet, it will allow construction on new gates at Terminal 2, but it all takes time. The runway won't be complete until 2027. That means no new Terminal 2 gates until 2030. And that's if RDU can address materials and labor shortages impacting construction projects. While RDU can make some inroads in advance of the actual gate expansion, such as its recent move to relocate Spirit Airlines to Terminal 1 alongside Southwest Airlines, a move that officials say will accommodate new service by Iceland Air and Avalo, actual construction is at least 5 years away. Terminal 2 is the airport's growth terminal. It's the only place set up for international traffic, but if RDU were actually able to attract flight service from its wish list, such as Frankfurt, Amsterdam, and Dublin, it would be tough to accommodate with the current setup. Sandifer is confident his team could make it work, but said it would be a major challenge. He says he would not be surprised to see the airport expedite plans to revamp Terminal 1. Pre-pandemic, officials had said it would cost $500 million to create a Terminal 1 that was comparable to Terminal 2. And that leads to another big issue giving officials pause: dollars. The cost estimates in that 2017 Vision 2040 plan are no longer realistic. Landguth says he's hearing estimates from other airports that projects are running 20 to 30% higher. Take the runway, which he says RDU has to complete, regardless of the other capital projects. We can design it, we can build it, but I'm not sure that we can control the cost at the end of the day, Sandifer says. We'll pay for it, but will $250 million turn into $350 million? Turn into something larger? And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. She makes finance more relatable. As a freshman, Ella Gupta was the only girl in her investment club at Cary Academy, and now she's on a mission to spread the importance of financial literacy to other young women. Concerned about the gap between those who have a safety net and those who do not, she wrote a book, Gen Z Money Sense. The S is a dollar sign in sense. Her goal was to make financial information more relatable. She started the Initiative for Financial Literacy Exploration to provide free workshops, lectures, and resources for young people, and has reached 120 schools. Recently, Gupta was one of five rising entrepreneurs to win $15,000 in the Prudential Emerging Visionaries Awards. Gupta says both her parents are physicians and faced enormous debts after medical school, so her mother helped her see the importance of financial planning. It's something I've always had a passion for, Gupta says. As for the prize money, she says, I'm planning to do some local book drives, and I'd like to start some sort of financial literary book club, but it will focus book distribution on under-resourced schools. Local leader recognized by SBA. Congratulations are in order for Kristen Hess, principal and CEO at HH Architecture in Raleigh. The U.S. Small Business Administration named Hess as North Carolina's Small Business Person of the Year, an award that honors leaders who help their businesses thrive in the tough times of the pandemic. Some of the projects Hess, an NC State University graduate, has worked on include the State Farmers Market Master Plan, the expansion of the North Carolina Zoological Park, and the new Steve Troxler Agricultural Sciences Center for the North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. Hess says the honor is not only a wonderful reminder of the core values that I strive to embody, but a testament of my commitment to serving, mentoring, and addressing the needs of North Carolina's people and communities. NC State releases second wine. NC State University, in a partnership with Shelton Vineyards, has rolled out its second wine in an ongoing partnership with in-state wineries. Each wine features an iconic university image, and the latest release recognizes one of the largest green spaces on the university's campus. There are about 4,000 bottles available for purchase either on Shelton's website or at the Vineyards Tasting Room in Dobson for $44.99 each. A portion of sales support NC State student scholarships. This follows Shelton releasing about 2,500 bottles of the Brickyard in October. The university says those bottles sold out in just 38 days. Tourism ready to take off in North Carolina. It's May and the summer vacation season is nearly upon us, and on the North Carolina coast, pandemic is a word they don't want to hear. In 2021, tourism spending at $28.9 billion In North Carolina, it was just 1% shy of the 2019 record, according to the North Carolina Department of Commerce. And 2022 looks primed to smash the record. For example, room occupancy tax collections in New Hanover County on the coast are already trending ahead of record-breaking figures in 2021, Wilmington Biz reports. We're looking beyond the pandemic, said Kim Huffam, New Hanover County Tourism Development Authority president and CEO. We don't even want to mention that word, really. Grab your sunscreen. Aberdeen turning school into homes. The town of Aberdeen approved plans to turn the old elementary school campus into housing during its May 9 meeting. Aberdeen and Moore County bought the former school for $900,000 last year, mostly for the gym and auditorium. In figuring out how to best utilize the rest of the 17.7 acres, the town proposed to build housing. That put Aberdeen in the unique position of approving a rezoning request for itself. During previous council meetings, some residents expressed concern about the number of housing units that would be built. Plans call for a maximum of 45 single-family homes and 36 multifamily units. And finally, Raleigh Project is now ready to rise. A large project close to North Hills in Raleigh has a new name and is about to go vertical. The Midtown Exchange project is now being called the Exchange Raleigh, and the first of two 12-story towers is about to rise. The build-out for the DeWitt Carolinas project will be 7 to 10 years, with a total investment of around $1 billion. The scope of the project is obvious when looking through the fences behind the Hilton Hotel on Wake Forest Road. The Exchange Raleigh will sweep across the site between St. Albans Drive and the Beltline before ending right where Kane Realty plans the North Hills Innovation District. Those two projects will be a major reshaping of the area, as development will stretch from Six Forks Road to Wake Forest Road. Both will integrate water into their designs, with the Exchange featuring a cascading waterway. Over the past several years, we have studied mixed-use projects across the country looking to establish the Exchange Raleigh as a destination unlike any other. With our infrastructure in place, we're eager to begin construction on the office tower and create what will undoubtedly be a world-class business address and a thriving urban development, DeWitt Carolina CEO Todd Said says. The first tower, to be called 1000 Social, will rise 12 stories and will be adjacent to a second tower, 2000 Social, connected by a glass walkway in a look DeWitt describes as a contemporary aesthetic. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to 52 Shades of Success, our continuing story. The headline, Fostering Change, How Lenovo's Ada Lopez is Using Her Personal Experiences to Move the DEI Needle in the Tech Field and Inspire Others. Story by Connie Gentry. About this project, the 52-week project showcases accomplishments, challenges, and opportunities of individuals and businesses run by people of color, women, immigrants, veterans, representatives from the LGBTQ+ community, and a few other groups forwarding the mission of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the greater Raleigh-Durham metro area. The project will also delve into important trends and issues relating to DEI. The room goes quiet when Ada Lopez shares her personal story. It doesn't matter if she's talking to a room full of technology executives or a rowdy class of middle schoolers. When Lopez describes her journey from Cuba to Venezuela to America, then orphaned as a young child and placed into the foster care system, which entailed 8 foster homes over 7 years, people lean in when she speaks. They especially pay attention when she reveals how she evolved from nearly becoming a high school dropout statistic to leading the product diversity office at Lenovo. Hers is a message of authenticity and relevancy, where education is the road forward, technology is the vehicle, and life lessons are the fuel. It started with defining moments in Lopez's youth. I lived with my mother in some challenging, very poor neighborhoods in Miami-Dade County in South Florida. It was a very difficult time for a single mom who didn't speak the language, she says. When I was 11 years old, my mother died in a car accident. I was in the car with her and was in the hospital for a very long time afterward, and when I recovered enough to go someplace, I didn't really have a place to go. That's when I entered the foster system. Lopez says her transition from the hospital to foster care began with a trip back to the mobile home where she had lived with her mother. I was given 2 shopping bags the size of little plastic grocery bags and told to gather my belongings, whatever would go in those 2 little bags. By high school, Lopez was ready to change her life. She told her social studies teacher that she wanted to drop out, take the GED, and get a job so she could pay rent and never have to worry about housing or foster placement again. The teacher said no to the plan and yes to taking action that changed the course of Lopez's life. She got a foster parent's license just for me, and the agreement was I would live with her, finish high school, and go to college, says Lopez, who studied both biology and education in college, because I decided that the same way she helped me, I was going to give back to others. Lopez spent the early years of her career teaching, beginning in Miami-Dade County and then in Wake County, where she made the first connection between technology and accessible inclusion. In Wake County, 28% of my students had a learning disability and had an individualized education plan. I taught students in wheelchairs, students who were blind, and students on the spectrum, she says. We were very fortunate because the school had a one-to-one laptop program, and the laptops were making individualized education possible for these kids. Technology was an equalizer. That experience shifted Lopez's focus from the classroom to technology, and she became a curriculum instructor and a product owner for science software K-12, working on projects with the National Braille Press and with NASA. I began to see how to embed accessible technology into a product and what that means if you start to think about accessible design from the beginning of a project, she says. Implementing accessible features after a product was already developed proved much more challenging. The cost of changes in budget and time in every sense was so difficult, Lopez adds. What I learned is that inclusive and accessible design needs to happen in the planning phase. That is the lesson she's taken to her role at Lenovo, where her team works with product development groups throughout the global enterprise to ensure that inclusive and accessible design practices are implemented from the beginning. Our mission is to drive development and validation of the technology to make sure the products are usable for our diverse customer base and that we are taking into account and minimizing any bias that is inherent in the product itself, Lopez says. Beyond her day job, Lopez has become an ambassador for creating equity through technology in areas of need across the communities. In the current school year, she initiated a partnership project at the Governor Moorhead School for visually impaired students, where high school students worked in a simulated virtual setting to assess if Lenovo laptops would be adequately accessible for visually impaired World War II veterans to use. The students had to learn about optic health conditions, perform research, work with different assisted technologies, and learn how to rate the accessibility of hardware and websites, Lopez explains. The research project reinforced tasks the high school students needed to learn how to open a Word document, save files to the established standards, and confidently provide feedback. The exercise provided Lenovo with insights into the viability of its technology among visually impaired users, but what excited Lopez most is that it addressed the students' aspirations to have meaningful work when they graduate, to have employment where they would be heard and be seen. In another recent event, Lopez spoke to students at Reedy Creek Middle School in Cary about careers in technology. She spoke with such passion about her life and the work she does and how it is making a difference. People think when you work for a technology company, you are creating technology for the masses, but the work Ada does is helping people individually, making sure the technology can be utilized by everyone, says Libby Richards, Community Engagement Manager for Lenovo North America. I think it's important to appreciate where you come from, opportunities you've been given, and figure out how to give back, Lopez says. And that's where her career, her work in the community, and even her family life reflect. She serves on the board for Dress for Success, the global nonprofit that supports women from challenged and low-income situations to successfully interview for jobs. And she seeks out any opportunity to support children in foster care, including connecting the Lenovo Foundation with Together We Rise. This year, Lenovo donated 300 laptops to children and youth served by Together We Rise. The Together We Rise program puts a lot of resources into the hands of kids in foster care, like giving them duffel bags filled with supplies they can use, Lopez says. Remember the two little plastic bags with my belongings? A lot of kids go into foster care with nothing but garbage bags to carry their belongings. Together We Rise gives them duffel bags with supplies they can actually use, like a toothbrush. Statistics are stacked against youth in foster care. Only 50% complete high school, and only 3% graduate from college. Having access to computers really helps students beat those odds, Lopez says. Most of the kids in foster care are lacking consistent access to technology because they are moving from home to home to home. Laptops can move with them, so it supports their education, and for me, education was life-changing. It paved my path. Fostering became family for Lopez. At the age of 32, she was legally adopted by her foster parents, and in addition to their biological teenage son, she and her husband have a 9-year-old daughter adopted from the foster system. And there are also two news articles in the 52 Shades of Success section. Racial breakdown among foster children revealing. The racial ethnic demographics of children in the U.S. foster care system are skewed to people of color, a report from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services reveals, according to its latest adoption and foster care analysis and reporting report. The DHHS shows that among children and youth in the foster system at the end of the last fiscal year, 43% were white, compared with 60% of the U.S. population, which is white. Black children accounted for 23% in the foster system. Hispanic, Latinx children totaled 22% of the foster system. Children with two or more races in their heritage numbered 8%, and children of American Indian, Alaskan Native heritage were 2%. In all of those segments, for children of color, the percentage of children in the foster system was disproportionately higher than that racial ethnic group's share of the total population. Asian children made up just 1% of the foster system, and the racial ethnic demographic for the remaining 1% of the children in the foster system was unknown. NC site added to national list. Three dormitory buildings at the Charlotte Hawkins Brown Museum, Palmer Memorial Institute, and Sedalia were added in the 2022 list of America's 11 most endangered historic places. The list is compiled annually by the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Today, the campus is a museum and state historic site that allows visitors to explore this unique environment where African American youth lived and learned during the greater part of the 20th century. At its height, it encompassed more than 300 acres and 14 buildings. This is a compelling recognition of the Charlotte Hawkins Brown Museum and its importance to the story of North Carolina and the nation, said Michelle Lanier, director of the North Carolina Division of State Historic Sites. It's a call to action for all of us to ensure a more inclusive history be preserved for future generations. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the OnTech Finance page, written by Lauren Onasorge. Austrian firm picks Durham for USHQ. HoloLight focuses on building technology to create the metaverse. A European company trying to make the metaverse real has picked Durham over Atlanta for its U.S. headquarters. Excuse me, that should be HoloLight, H-O-L-O-Light. A 7-year-old company based in Austria with more than $12 million in outside capital has picked Durham's One City Center for its U.S. operation and has already started the interviews in hopes of reaching 10 local employees by the end of the year. Helmut Gold, the firm's chief corporate development officer, explains the technology is helping the metaverse move beyond the buzz and into reality. All of these ideas of metaverse will stay theory if you cannot break through the limitations of mobile devices, the technical limitations in terms of computing power, and that is the technology we're bringing to the table with streaming, he says. The firm has a new streaming-as-a-service product dubbed XR Now, which it claims brings the power of the cloud to mobile XR devices. The company partners with entities such as Microsoft and Amazon Web Services, serving customers that run the gambit from BMW Group to Procter & Gamble, and they're buying in as the firm has assembled more than 100 enterprise customers. While the parent company at 60 employees is based in Austria, Gold says the goal is to build a U.S. company with European roots. We don't want to build a European company in the U.S., he says. The exponential growth that we're looking for will have to be very much supported from the U.S. The next step, building out the office. Interviews are happening now. The goal is to end the year with at least 10 people in the triangle, he says. We're looking for smart and eager people who want to build the business, he says, noting the firm is starting with sales and marketing roles. Triangle's IPO talk could dim as markets slump. A few months ago, expectations were high the Triangle's next big IPO could be looming. But with interest rates rising and a stock market plunge, the window appears much murkier. That might change the plans of some of the Triangle's most anticipated exits, from Cary SAS Institute to up-and-coming Raleigh firm Pendo. Mitch Mumma, co-founder of Durham's InterSouth Partner, says, later-stage companies are going to have a more difficult time exiting because now all the trading companies are worth 25% less, he says. Lister Delgado, co-founder of Durham's Idea Fund Partners, says the current market could change the timing of things. What it does is it keeps them looking through the window, seeing if it's a good window, he says. I wouldn't be surprised if they were thinking about doing something right now. SaaS CEO Jim Goodnight had gone on the record last year saying the analytics company was aiming for an initial public offering by 2024, and IPO rumors had escalated for firms like Raleigh's Pendo, which in 2021 raised $150 million at a $2.6 billion valuation. Our job is to prepare the company to possibly be a public company, Pendo CEO Todd Olson said last year. Tech startup scores biggest yet funder. An entrepreneur pushing to allow executive coaches to win back your time through automation has closed on more than $800,000 with plans for another raise in the coming months. Raleigh-based Zoe, spelled Z-O-E-E, founded by Nicole Lowe, has closed on more than $834,000 from eight investors, according to a securities filing. The raise brings the firm's total haul to more than $1 million. Lowe started Zoe 3 years ago, securing her first $100,000 from an angel investor before winning a slot at Techstars last year. That fueled her with enough money for a soft launch, which attracted more than 100 users. The company offers what it calls a telehealth coaching platform that connects people looking for coaches. The firm not only matches coaches with clients, but it also offers back office support from video conferencing to note taking and client management. It's a fast start for Lowe, whose previous life was in executive sales, flying across the U.S. to close deals. The travel was taxing, but the real hit came when her husband was diagnosed with serious heart issues. She needed a change, and fast. Fast forward to executive coaching, but that came with its own challenges. She had a business training coaches, but found the lack of tools in the industry frustrating. Solving those led her to start Zoe. I had just come out of corporate America, and I knew there was a better way to do business, she says. Wagner exits as Credit Suisse leadership in RTP. 4 years after taking the reins from longtime site leader Jim Kapton, Sophia Wagner quietly left Credit Suisse last month to pursue other opportunities. The company has promoted local IT head Kevin Walker to site leader. Wagner, in a statement, said she was especially proud of the meaningful partnerships we've further developed in the community, which will continue to prove mutually beneficial for years to come. She also said she is staying in Raleigh and looking forward to my next chapter. The Swiss company has about 2,500 employees in the Triangle, according to data compiled by Triangle Business Journal. And then finally, in the section called He Said It, we have a quote from Rob Thomas, Senior Vice President of Global Markets at IBM, on how the company is focused on data, automation, security, consulting, and the hybrid cloud. Red Hat is the engine for hybrid cloud. Think of it as the core of the strategy. When we say hybrid cloud, that is Red Hat. When we build out our assets for data and automation and security, they all run on Red Hat. And now we turn to the On Greater Triangle Growth page written by Evan Hoopfer. Georgia home builder targets Johnston County. Ashton Woods plans a development on 270 acres near Smithfield. One of the largest home builders in the Triangle bought over 270 acres in Johnston County, where it plans to build about 850 new homes. Ashton Woods, based in the Atlanta suburb of Alpharetta, Georgia, purchased the land. Raleigh-based Greenfield Communities, which bought a large portion of the site last August for under $2 million, was the seller. The development, called Crescent Mills, sits along Strickland Road near Wilson's Mills, a small town that sits about 10 minutes north of Smithfield. Crescent Mills will feature a mix of townhomes and single-family homes, says Rob Tesser, Vice President of Land Acquisitions for the Raleigh Division of Ashton Woods. This will be the second 800-plus home development for Ashton Woods in the Triangle, as the company is also working on The Point in Rollsville. Both projects will be represented by Ashton Woods Homes and Starlight Homes so as to offer multiple product lines and price points, Tesser says. Starlight is a subsidiary of Ashton Woods. Greenfield Communities was planning to develop the community. However, Matt Brubaker, president of Greenfield Communities, says it became apparent for the company that the best business decision was to pass this fully approved project to a fantastic home builder like Ashton Woods. We're just a small local development company who really strives to do everything with excellence, and we realized that we needed to focus our efforts on some other developments currently in our committed pipeline, Brubaker says. sadly, there are times in life where tough decisions need to be made, and this was one of them. Developer buys 365-acre farm in Harnett County. An active developer in Lee County turned his gaze east toward Harnett County recently with a big land buy. Bobby and Elizabeth Branch purchased a 365-acre farm in Broadway for $4 million, according to a deed filed April 25. The land sits just off U.S. Highway 421 near the Harnett-Lee County border. Bobby Branch is an active land developer in Sanford and Lee County. "We bought the Broadway property for future investment," Branch says. When asked if it would be for a residential or commercial development, he said more than likely residential. The property has a 2,434-square-foot three-bedroom, two-bathroom home on the site that was recently renovated. Gardner Reynolds and Frank Gombatz of Legacy Farms and Ranches of North Carolina and Fonville Morrissey, along in Foster Company, represented the seller, Tim Patterson. Raleigh investor grabs site near Clayton. Stevens Enterprises LLC, based in Raleigh, purchased 211.83 acres outside Clayton for over $11.8 million, according to a deed filed April 29. When asked about his plans for the land, Matt Stevens of Stevens Enterprises says there were no specifics as of now to share. "Seemed like a good area to invest in," he says. The land has features that usually intrigue industrial users. It sits along a rail line and near U.S. Highway 70, which is slated to become Interstate 42 in the coming years. Stevens has industrial property elsewhere in the Greater Triangle, namely East Coast Logistics Park in Dunn. The industrial park has room for up to 1.5 million square feet of industrial space. And in a section called He Said It, we have a quote from Matt Winters, an executive vice president at JLL, which is a marketing, the Triangle Innovation Point megasite. VinFast is occupying all of TIP East, nearly 2,000 acres, but there's still ample room for companies in TIP West. In total, TIP West could accommodate 2.5 to 3 million square feet. And finally, a big number. 77. The number of lots Starlight Homes is planning to build in Lynn Ridge, a Harnett County development that sits off Lipscomb Road a couple of miles east of downtown Anger. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to A Better World, inside the Triangle's nonprofit scene. First, we have a column written by Dr. Yvette Marie Miller, who is the American Red Cross Executive Medical Officer for the Donor and Client Support Center in Charlotte. The headline, Blood Donors Vital in Battle Against Sickle Cell Disease. About 100,000 people in the U.S., most of whom are of African descent, are living with sickle cell disease, the most common inherited blood disorder in the country. The American Red Cross is seeking partners to participate in a sickle cell initiative to raise awareness of the needs of patients with sickle cell disease and the unique ability of blood donors who are Black to help in their treatment. Sickle cell disease causes red blood cells to be sticky, hard, and crescent-shaped instead of soft and round. This makes it difficult for blood to flow smoothly and carry oxygen to the rest of the body, which may lead to severe pain, tissue and organ damage, or even strokes. When patients living with sickle cell disease face a crisis, blood transfusions can make a life-saving difference. For those who rely on regular transfusions to treat symptoms, blood donations from those of the same race or similar ethnicity can be critical. Many patients with sickle cell disease who are Black have distinct markers on their red blood cells that can make it difficult to find a compatible unit of blood in other donor populations. Because a single patient can require thousands of blood transfusions throughout their life, receiving blood from a donor with the same race or ethnicity often provides the best opportunity for a well-matched unit. And we'll go ahead and stop there with this article, as the main point was that the Red Cross is encouraging organizations, companies, and employee affinity groups to consider hosting a Red Cross blood drive in support of their initiative. And in some nonprofit briefs, Community Music School honors life of philanthropists. Raleigh nonprofit Community Music School is hosting a musical celebration May 18 to honor the late philanthropist Tom McGuire and provide life-changing benefits of music education to more Wake County youth. The event will be from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the A.J. Fletcher Opera Theater. The music school charges just $1 per lesson for students who might not otherwise be able to afford lessons. The Connells, one of North Carolina's most successful indie rock bands, are the featured performers, and CMS alumni and students will also perform. Children who have access to quality music education score higher on standardized tests, have larger vocabularies, stronger reading skills, and higher self-esteem, CMS Executive Director Melanie Doner said. They are more likely to stay engaged in school, graduate, and pursue higher education. McGuire was a longtime executive and consultant in the nonprofit sector and died unexpectedly in September 2018 on a trip to France. Volunteers to set up for children in foster care. More than 70 volunteers are expected May 13th for an event from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. to provide support for children entering foster care. May is National Foster Care Awareness Month, and the nonprofit Comfort Cases is teaming up with Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina to host a packing party to provide comfort and personal care items for youth entering the North Carolina foster care system. More than 70 volunteers will fill backpacks with new personal care items, including pajamas, a blanket, hygiene kit, a book, and more. Over 700 backpacks and duffel bags from the packing party will be donated to local nonprofits serving youth in foster care. Organizers say North Carolina currently has about 10,000 youth in foster care. Leader of Raleigh Housing Authority leaving. Executive Director Wayne Felton is leaving the Raleigh Housing Authority after 16 years for a new opportunity, RHA announced. I appreciate his leadership most recently through the pandemic and how beautifully he orchestrated changes and adjustments in operations to serve our community during a trying time, said Arnie Morris, chair of RHA Board of Commissioners. He was instrumental in the redevelopment of Halifax Court and Chavis Heights, leading those projects as the HOPE 6 coordinator. Felton will stay through June 2nd, when Liz Edgerton will begin serving as interim executive director while a search is conducted. Nonprofit University offers opportunities. An affiliate of online profit, a nonprofit Western Governors University has signed a partnership agreement with Teach for America, North Carolina, to provide TFANC members and employees with multiple paths to higher education and professional development. WGU will award up to 5 Teach for America North Carolina scholarships per year, provided as a tuition credit of $625 per 6-month term, renewable for up to 4 terms. As part of the agreement, WGU North Carolina will also assist in the execution of enrollment campaigns and provide information about Teach for America to qualified students. Since 1990, Teach for America has supported a diverse network of leaders who expand opportunity for children across North Carolina. WGU also announced a partnership with Prospanica, a nonprofit dedicated to empowering Hispanics to extend their education. WGU will allow Prospanica's more than 30,000 members to pursue degree programs and credentials at WGU, with members eligible to apply for $2,500 scholarships. And now we'll turn to the On Healthcare Higher Ed page, written by Zach Ezone. UNC Duke clash over Durham County Health. Both healthcare systems want to expand in the market. Two of the Triangle's largest health systems are again competing for beds in Durham County, less than a year after receiving approval from state regulators to build a 40-bed hospital in Research Triangle Park. UNC Health is aiming to expand the project. Meanwhile, Duke Health, which is appealing the state's decision regarding UNC's planned hospital, is also looking to build out beds in Durham County after being denied last year. UNC Health wants to add 34 acute care beds to its RTP hospital, which was approved for 40 beds in September. This would raise the estimated cost of the project from $251.9 million to $279.3 million, according to a certificate of need application the health system filed with the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. Duke Health, on the other hand, is proposing adding 68 acute care beds to Duke University Hospital in a project that's estimated to cost about $4.8 million. In an application filed last year, state officials denied Duke's plan to develop no more than 40 acute care beds and add 4 operating rooms to existing projects, including 2 at Duke Ambulatory Surgery Center, Arrington, off Page Road, for a total cost of $4.15 million. The proposals from both health systems follow the release of the 2022 State Medical Facilities Plan earlier this year, which identifies the need for an additional 68 acute care beds in Durham County. Hospitals had until April 18 to apply for the license to add the beds. In its Durham County Certificate of Need application, UNC Health argues that expanding its plans for the RTP hospital would be more feasible, cost-effective and efficient than building the originally planned 40-bed facility and adding this capacity later. We would also develop a larger emergency department and add space for more imaging and other service to help support the larger facility, UNC Health stated. After DHHS approved the UNC hospital last year, Duke Health appealed the decision. This appeal is reviewed by a judge with the North Carolina Office of Administrative Hearings. The judge has until July 17 to make a decision, which can be appealed further to the State Court of Appeals. Due to this appeals process and the proposed changes in its application, UNC Health officials expect the facility to be operational on July 1, 2029, according to application documents. Previously, UNC Health officials anticipated the RTP hospital opening in 2026. And now we turn to the On Retail and Restaurants page, written by Laura Bromette. Mitch's Tavern preps to reopen. New life coming for a beloved location on Hillsborough Street. Mitch's Tavern, a legendary spot on Hillsborough Street, is fully opening for the first time in over 2 years with new operators on board. Van Alston and Chris Post, the team running Mojo's Burger Joint, have joined owner Mitch Hazori to help manage the tavern. The group has been working to come to an agreement with the building's landlord and restore the space since November, and will be ready to officially open in the coming weeks. Alston and Post, who have looked to Hazori as a mentor throughout their careers in the industry, are now part owners of the space. The pair also own downtown Raleigh Bar Slim's and operate new nightclub Zenith Raleigh. Hazori will still be involved with the tavern, but Alston and Post will handle day-to-day operations. Located at 2426 Hillsborough Street, Mitch's Tavern sits across from NC State University's campus. The local spot was also featured in the 1988 film Bull Durham. Not only will the upstairs space be brought back to life, but the space beneath Mitch's Tavern will also greet customers for the first time in decades. Known as the College Grill or Reds, the space is leased by Hazori but has sat unused for nearly 50 years. The space, with room for about 70 people, will be rented out for parties or events. It has a prep kitchen and a bar, and Mitch's Tavern will cater events with food and alcohol. The resurrection of Mitch's Tavern happened purely by accident, Alston says. He ran into Hazori at a coffee shop and struck up a conversation about the tavern, a spark that formed their partnership. Had the interaction not happened, Mitch's Tavern would be nothing but a memory, Alston says. If you would have told me when I was 25 years old that one day I would be an owner in this place, it would have been my wildest dream, Alston says. I own a place with so much history, and now I'm able to shepherd it for the next generation that will follow me. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook. And this is a column written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. Questions about light rail project remain. Most of the readers of this publication are interested in business. They want to know about mergers and acquisitions, layoffs, growth strategy, operational challenges of companies and sectors, and most importantly, about people who are leading public and private entities around our region. So if I asked the same readers how they would feel if their chief financial officers or finance executives told them that they couldn't provide a detailed report on how money is spent at their companies for at least 6 years, I am certain of the next steps that would be initiated by the CEO and the board. Reading Go Triangle's detailed report on how some $157 million of Durham and Chapel Hill taxpayers' money was spent, Chair Brenda Howerton of the Durham Board of Commissioners rightly stated, "I know the community is perplexed as to why it's taken 6 years to get this report." In the commissioners' meeting last week, Howerton also said because of the delay in the report, there is a sense of distrust in the community. And that is the biggest point of all. Go Triangle essentially may have killed any kind of regional commuter rail project talk for a while. Before getting approval from all parties to make sure the 18-mile train tracks and associated access were kosher, the project undertakers decided that it was necessary to do the engineering, design, and spend additional money on management consulting, all before they got the green light from Duke University, an entity that eventually told Go Triangle, no tracks can go through our property. And the project was killed in 2019. By that time, according to the report, $157 million was spent, with about $125 million coming from Durham County coffers. It was called the prep phase. The Go Triangle Board approved the contracts relating to the management and design of the project to at least four major companies that received a little more than $130 million of the $157 million. Staff, office expenses, and administrative made up about $16 million, and real estate expenses were about $6 million. Without a doubt, most of these costs were needed just to make sure the authority got the $1 billion from the Federal Transit Administration, the federal body that agreed to support the light rail project. So the question is, why were the taxpayer representatives of the two counties, Durham and Orange, kept in the dark regarding the recurring expenses for so long? Could it be because someone would have said to get all the approvals first before spending all this money? It is not clear if either of the counties asked for periodic expense reports of the project back some 10 years ago. In 2011 and 2012, voters in Durham and Orange counties approved half-cent sales taxes to fund transportation improvements, including the light rail. It was all part of an ambitious plan to make universities, companies, and eventually the state government services weave into a transportation grid to remove cars from roads in one of the fastest-growing areas in the country. Now, Wake County is hearing about a new commuter rail project. We shouldn't do anything with it until we find out the processes and the people who were put in charge of the Durham-Orange light rail project and how and why were triggers not put in place before getting all the approvals in the bag. And I'm still waiting on that call from the Go Triangle folks. And in our general news stories, 120 home community in Fuquay-Varina wins approval. After initial skepticism from the town of Fuquay-Varina, a rezoning off Lake Wheeler Road was approved during a recent town board meeting for a community with as many as 120 residential units on 35 acres. Wakefield Development of Raleigh asked for a zoning change last year for the Banks family farmland at 8537 Lake Wheeler Road, a residential agriculture zone, to a mixed-density residential zone in order to build a townhouse and single-family residential community. The master plan for the community, currently called the Banks Family Farm, proposes a minimum of 55 attached townhouses along with a minimum of 20 detached townhouses, a minimum of 31 single-family lots varying in size from 8,000 to 12,000 square feet. And we'll go ahead and stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. And if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.